I'm Bruce Johnson, and this is the second session on C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. Those of you here last time will not need this quick preface, but I want to give some background and move as quickly as we can to the text itself, because as with any great author, the whole point is you want to pay attention to what the author says, and that's what we're going to be doing tonight. But some introduction is helpful, even for those of you who were here last night. You know the theme for our summer and for our week here is this, on earth as in heaven. And much of our emphasis comes on this first prepositional phrase, on earth. What are we doing here on earth? And that's fine. That's the way it should be. But it's not the only way that it should be, and not the only emphasis. The way the prayer goes is the rest of it, as in heaven. And we have less conception of what that's all about. I mean, we have a hard enough time deciding what it means to do it on earth, but when we try and conceive of what it means that whatever it is that we're to do on earth is as in heaven, and then try and get some picture in our mind of what is in heaven, we have much more trouble. C.S. Lewis and others, he isn't doing it, attempts to do basically what I think you can only do, and that is use your imagination. And C.S. Lewis attempts to engage our imagination in what all of this may be about. Now, he has great precedence for that, but it's not only C.S. Lewis and a lot of great writers in history. But what did Jesus do? Jesus, mostly, some of the greatest insights we have are in parables. And what are parables but attempting to engage our imagination, our minds, in a process of imagining what heaven must be like? And that's what C.S. Lewis tries to do in this book, to gauge our imagination in an effort to help us see what heaven's like. But as any engagement of heaven, you've got to deal, at least in the Christian tradition, and I think with most understandings of human nature, you've got to deal with hell. So what this book is a depiction in the first couple of chapters, which we surveyed yesterday, of an imaginary hell. And this imaginary hell is probably very different than anything that you've imagined so far. The usual picture of hell is hellfire and brimstone. Maybe some other things as well with that. This is a rather different one. It's a gray hell. It's a dreary hell. It's a hell that's full of people who are totally self-preoccupied. They are so self-preoccupied that they cannot tolerate anyone intruding on their space. Their psychological space, their geographical space, their emotional space. And so in this imaginary hell, when anyone begins to intrude on my space, I move away. And if someone starts to intrude on that space, I move away again. And then if someone intrudes on that space, I move away again. And so in this gray, dreary hell, there's vast, open, empty spaces of nothingness because people keep moving farther and farther away from each other so they can engage only in their own curved in upon themselves images of what it is that they think they have to preserve and clutch tightly to themselves. So hell is this gray empty place, and into this gray empty place in the third chapter comes a bus, of all things, a bus. Well, this is C.S. Lewis's marvelous imagination. And this bus offers people who wish to do so a trip, you can imagine, to heaven. Okay? Well, some hardy souls, if we can say hardy souls, get on the bus and take this trip to heaven. Well, I know if you can imagine, but some of what they start to go through is what then the rest of The Great Divorce is about. Because, so we'll quickly discover, what he's pointing out is that you can't have a marriage of heaven and hell. If you choose heaven, you're going to reject hell. If you really want hell, you can have it, but you're not going to get heaven along with it. You have to choose. So the Great Divorce. These people start to experience a whole bunch of different things. The first thing that they experience is a great sense of light. Imagine grayness, dullness, always a sense of twilight, a foggy, overcast kind of climate, and moving into a great place of light and openness. And then they start to experience the bright people. The bright people start coming to welcome them. And when they start to experience the bright people, they discover that they are transparent. You can see right through them. And if you've been at the last session of Reading the Great Divorce, you can imagine some of how C.S. Lewis describes that and the horrible experience they start to have when they discover that they are transparent. And these people start to welcome them in and engage them in some beautiful dialogue. We'll take just one more minute to describe what happened in chapter 4, which was the one we read last time. And those of you here, let's help the rest gather what happened. There is a person who arrives and stands very much on his, what should we say? What's a good summary of those who were here last time, of the ghost who arrives, and he stands very much on his own rights? I want my rights, he was insisting. And he arrives, and the absolute marvelous way in which C.S. Lewis describes it is that the bright person who comes to meet, who comes to welcome this person, is, what's one of the first things we learn about this person?
A murderer.
A murderer.
And a former employee.
And a former
employee. Yes, oh, even better. Yeah, right on. A former employee and a murderer, okay? And this person, this ghost that takes this trip now, can't understand why this bright person is welcoming them. They just can't grasp it at all. And so the ghost starts to inquire, well, where's the person you murdered? And the bright person says, well, that person's waiting to welcome you as well. And then the bright person tries to have that person there understand that the reason this bright person was sent to that ghost is that this bright person had murdered the ghost that was coming along in her heart all these years as a former employee of the person and would have liked to have killed that person. And this person now had to come back and welcome this person and ask for their forgiveness. But the person couldn't accept it because they thought they'd been the ideal boss all these years. So you get some sense of the flavor. And it's just the briefest description of what's going on. Then, that was chapter 4. Chapter 5, for those, we will not deal with it here in these sessions, but if any of you would like to read more of it, it's one of the more humorous exposés of false intellectualism in Christianity that I've ever encountered. In fact, the epitome, if any of you have any bit of anti-clericalism in you, it happens to be a bishop who is the false intellectual who cannot stand heaven because heaven doesn't conform to the bishop's image of what heaven should be like. So if any of you enjoyed that kind of humor, that's in chapter 5. Chapter 6 has a marvelous description. I've summarized here, parts of heaven are too much for hell. The person tries to take an apple that they want to take back when the bus goes back to the great town, and they find they can't lift up the apple. It's too heavy for them to carry. But the whole symbolism in it is you can't take parts of heaven with you to hell. If you want to deal more with that, we'll come back to it. The seventh chapter deals with cynicism. Beautiful expose of the problem of cynicism. The chapter right before the one we're going to take up deals with shame. The person who is so caught up in their shame that they cannot use the shame as a vehicle for seeing that it's God's means of helping them see themselves. That chapter ends, in only the way C.S. Lewis can describe it, with one of the bright people blowing on a horn. And a whole herd, I guess you'd have to call them, of unicorns shows up. And only the way in which in this book you can imagine that occurring. And the person with shame the person blowing the horn thought that the person would maybe get some hope from the unicorn, and the person turns and runs back on the bus, and then we get the introduction to this chapter here. Well, that's enough introduction. You may have a lot of questions, but try to hang on to them, because it's important we get the dialogue of this particular section here. And this section is right smack in the middle of the book, and it introduces an important change in the book. And I'm delighted Naren can be here, because I didn't fully realize that he's also Scottish, and you will quickly learn, if you didn't know before, that the spiritual mentor for C.S. Lewis is a man named George MacDonald. Now, some of you may know about George MacDonald. If you do not know about George MacDonald, and like C.S. Lewis, I would strongly urge you to get hold of anything you can of George MacDonald's to read. He mostly has novels. Now, don't be prepared if you're going to read George MacDonald for a lot of crime and mystery and sex. It's a good old-fashioned meat and potatoes type novel. If you like good old-fashioned meat and potatoes type novel, there's nothing better than the novels of George MacDonald. That's the hero that Bob's going to read this portion of the dialogue, and we're introduced to, and they start to discuss some of these issues of heaven and hell. Let me think if I've laid the groundwork that I want. I think so. Now, a couple of you came in late, and if you, like me, like to follow along in any dialogue, someone's welcome to come up here and sit in this chair, if any of you would like to, and can share with my book. Where are you? Sure can. And if any of you others who just came in would like to sit next to somebody else's book, why don't those of you who have a book hold up a hand, if that helps anyone. Okay. Yeah, good. More than welcome. Okay, now, we're going to pick up right after these unicorns have left, and C.S. Lewis, who is the narrator here, who's experiencing, he's one of the passengers on the bus, by the way, so he's experiencing all this. And Bob is going to read the portions of George MacDonald. Oh, I need a volunteer to read the other portion. This can be either male or female. Somebody who likes to read. It isn't major portions. It's just mainly C.S. Lewis raising some of the kind of questions that come up. What anybody would like to read? You like doing that kind of thing? Anyone to volunteer? Should I just pick out some? You're on. You read the portions where it's I. I'll point to you if you happen to miss the cue. Okay? Now, first comes in somebody that C.S. Lewis, as the author and this person on the bus, does not recognize, and comes in with,
"Where are you going?"
said a voice with a strong Scotch accent. Marvelous. You'll see how appropriate this is the more we go on. I stopped and looked. The sound of the unicorns had long since died away, and my flight had brought me to open country. I saw the mountains where the unchanging sunrise lay, and in the foreground, two or three pines on a little knoll with some large smooth rocks and heather. On one of the rocks sat a very tall man, almost a giant, with a flowing beard. I had not yet looked one of the solid people, or bright people, in the face. Now when I did so, I discovered that one sees them with a kind of double vision.
Heavenly music?
That's marvelous. Whatever that is, the bright people are coming. Here was an enthroned and shining God. Now, a double vision. On the one hand, here was an enthroned and shining God whose ageless spirit weighed upon mine like a burden of solid gold. And yet, at the very same moment, here was an old, weather-beaten man who might have been a shepherd, such a man as tourists think simple because he is honest, and neighbors think deep for the same reason. His eyes had the far-seeing look of one who has lived long in open, solitary places, and somehow I divined the network of wrinkles which must have surrounded them before rebirth had washed him in immortality.
Where are you going?
I don't quite know, I said.
You can sit and talk to me then,
he said, making room for me on the stone.
I don't know you, sir,
said I, taking my seat beside him.
My name's George,
he answered.
George MacDonald.
Oh,
I cried.
Then you can tell me. You at least will not deceive me.
Then, supposing that these expressions of confidence needed some explanation, I tried, trembling, to tell this man all that his writings had done for me. I tried to tell how a certain frosty afternoon at a Leatherhead station, a train station near London, where I bought my first copy of Phantasthes, being about 16 years old at the time. If you want some of the best kind of science fiction that precedes any of the existing science fiction, in fact, is a model of much of the existing science fiction, it's the novel Phantasthes. And that had been to me what the first sight of Beatrice or Beatrice had been to Dante. Here begins the new life, and that vision was what prompted the whole Divine Comedy. I started to confess how long before that life had delayed in the regions of imagination merely, how slowly and reluctantly I had come to admit that his Christianity had more than an accidental connection, how hard I had tried not to see the true name of the quality which first met me in the books, his holiness. He laid his hand upon mine and stopped me.
Son, said, your love, all love is inexpressible value to me. But it may save you precious time if I inform you that I am already well acquainted with these biographical details. In fact, I've noticed that your memory misleads you in one or two particulars.
Oh,
said I, and I became very still.
You'd started to talk of something more profitable.
Sir,
said I.
I had almost forgotten it, and I have no anxiety about the answer now, though I still have curiosity. Is it about these ghosts? Do any of them stay?
Meaning stay in the new country.
Can they stay? Is any real choice offered to them? How do they come to be here?
Did you ever hear of the refrigerarium? A man with your advantages might have read of it in Prudentius, not to mention Jeremy Taylor.
The name is familiar, sir, but I'm afraid I've forgotten what it means.
It means that the damned have holidays. Excursions, you understand.
Excursions to this country?
For those that will take them. Of course, most of the silly creatures don't. They prefer taking trips back to the earth. They go and play tricks on poor daft women you call mediums. They go and try to assert their ownership on some house that once belonged to them. And that's when you get that's what you call haunting. Or they go to spy on their children. Or literally ghosts hang about public libraries to see if anybody's still reading their books.
But if they come here, can they really stay?
Aye. You'll have heard of the Emperor Trajan did.
But I don't understand. Is judgment not final? Is there really a way out of hell into heaven?
It depends on the way you're using the words. If they leave that grey town behind, it'll not have been hell. To any that leaves it, it's purgatory. And perhaps you'd better not call this country heaven. Not deep heaven, you understand.
And here he smiled at me.
You can call it the Valley of the Shadow of Life. And yet, to those who stay here, it'll have been heaven from the first. And you can call those sad streets in the town yonder the Valley of the Shadow of Death. But to those who remain there, they will have been in hell, even from the beginning.
I suppose he saw that I looked puzzled, for presently he spoke again.
Son, you cannot in your present state understand eternity. When Anodus looked through the door of the timeless, he brought no message back. But you can get some likeness off it if you say that both good and evil, when they are full grown, become retrospective. Not only this valley, but all this earthly past will have been heaven to those who are saved. Not only the twilight in that town, but all their life on earth too, will then be seen by the damned to have been hell. That's what mortals misunderstand. They say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it, not knowing that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory. And of some sinful pleasure, they say, let me have this, and I'll take the consequences. Little dreaming how damnation will spread back and back into their past and contaminate the pleasures of the sin. Both processes begin even before death. The good man's past begins to change so that his forgiven sins and remembered sorrows take on a quality of heaven. The bad man's past already conforms to his badness and is filled only with dreariness. And that's why at the end of all things, when the sun rises here and the twilight turns into blackness down there, the blessed will say, "We've never lived anywhere except in heaven." And the lost, "We were always in hell." And both will speak truly.
Is not that very hard, sir?
I mean, what is the real sense of what they'll say? In the actual language of the lost, the words will be different, no doubt. One will say, "He's always served his country, right or wrong." And another that he has sacrificed everything to his art. And some that they've never been taken in. And some that, thank God, they've always looked after number one. And nearly all that, at least, they've been true to themselves.
And the saved.
Ah, the saved. What happens to them is best described as the opposite of a mirage. What seemed when they entered it to be a veil of misery turns out, when they look back, to have been a well. And where present experiences saw only salt deserts, memory truthfully records that the pools were full of water. Then those people are right.
No.
Then those people are right to say that heaven and hell are only states.
Do not blaspheme. Hell is a state
of
mind.
The point is, he was saying states of mind.
Sorry. Do not blaspheme. Hell is a state of mind. You never said a truer word. And every state of mind left to itself, every shutting up of the creature within the dungeon of its own mind is, in the end, hell. But heaven's not a state of mind. Heaven is reality itself. And that is fully real is heaven. All that is fully real is heavenly. For all that can be shaken will be shaken, and only the unshakable remains.
But there is a real choice after death? My Roman Catholic friends would be surprised, for to them, souls in purgatory are already saved. And my Protestant friends would like it no better, for they'd say that the tree lies as it falls.
Ah, they're both right, maybe. Do not fash yourself with such questions. You cannot fully understand the relations of choice and time till you're beyond both. And you were not brought here to study such curiosities. What concerns you is the nature of the choice itself, and that you can watch the making. And that you can watch the making.
Well, sir,
I said,
that also needs explaining. What do they choose, these souls who go back? I have yet seen no others. And how can they choose it?
Milton was right,
said my teacher.
The choice of every lost soul can be expressed in the words, "Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." There's always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. There's always something they prefer to joy, that is, to reality. You see it easily enough in a spoiled child that would sooner miss its play and its supper than say it was sorry and be friends. You call it the sulks. But in adult life it has 100 fine names. Achilles' wrath and Coriolanus' grandeur. Revenge and injured merit and self-respect and tragic greatness and proper pride.
Then is no one lost through the undignified vices, sir? Through mere sensuality?
Some are, no doubt. The sensualist, I'll allow you, begins by pursuing a real pleasure, though a small one. His sin is the less. But the time comes on when, though the pleasure becomes less and less, and the craving fiercer and fiercer, and though he knows that joy can never come that way, yet he prefers the joy, the mere fondling of the unappeasable lust, and would not have it taken from him. He'd fight to the death to keep it. He'd like well to be able to scratch, but even when he can scratch no more, he'd rather itch than not.
He was silent for a few minutes, and then began again.
You'll understand, there are innumerable forms of this choice, sometimes forms that one hardly thought of at all on earth. There was a creature came here not long ago and went back. Sir Archibald, they called him. In his earthly life, he'd been interested in nothing but survival. He'd written a whole shelf full of books about it. He began by being philosophical, but in the end, he took up psychical research. It grew to be his only occupation. Experimenting, lecturing, running a magazine, and traveling too, digging out queer stories about Tibetan lamas and being initiated into brotherhoods in Central Africa. Proofs, and more proofs, and then more proofs again were what he wanted. It drove him mad if ever he saw anyone taking an interest in anything else. He got into trouble during one of your wars for running up and down the country telling them not to fight because it wasted a lot of money that ought to be spent on research. Well, in good time, the poor creature died and came here. And there was no power in the universe would have prevented him from staying and going on to the mountains. But did you think that did him any good? This country was no use to him at all. Everyone here had survived already. Nobody took the least interest in the question. There was nothing more to prove. His occupation was clean gone. Of course, if he would only have admitted that he'd mistaken the means for the end and had a good laugh at himself, he could have begun all over again like a little child and entered into joy. But he'd not do that. He cared nothing about joy. In the end, he went away.
How fantastic.
Do you think so?
Said the teacher with a piercing glance.
It's nearer to such as you than you think. There have been men before now that got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself. As if the good Lord had nothing to do but exist. There have been some who were so occupied in spreading Christianity that they never gave a thought to Christ. Man, you see it in smaller matters. Did you ever know a lover of books that with all his first editions and signed copies had lost the power to read them? Or an organizer of charities that had lost all love for the poor? It's the subtlest of all the snares.
Moved by a desire suddenly to change the subject, I asked why the solid people, since they were full of love, did not go down into hell to rescue the ghosts. Why were they content simply to meet them on this plane? One would have expected a more militant charity.
You'll understand that better before you go. In the meantime, I must tell you, you've come further for the sake of the ghosts than you can understand. Every one of us lives only to journey further and further into the mountains. Every one of us has interrupted that journey and retraced immeasurable distances to come down today on the mere chance of saving some ghosts. Of course, it's also joy to do so, but you cannot blame us for that. But it would be no use to come further, even if it were possible. The sane would do no good if they made themselves mad to help madmen.
But what of the poor ghosts who never get into the omnibus at all?
Everyone who wishes it does. Never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done." And those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done." All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. To those who seek, find. Those who knock, it is opened.
Okay. I'm going to pause there. Well, for those of you who haven't been exposed to C.S. Lewis before, you can see why some of us consider him our spiritual mentor and return to him time and time again for spiritual nourishment. It's almost like all that's here is so full, it's hard to know where to begin with it. There are a number of things that can be emphasized, but I would rather, as we did yesterday, hear some of your comments or concerns, some of the things you heard coming through, anything that struck you, anything you'd like re-emphasize that you heard, maybe you'd like to go back to that section.
This was written at a particular time in history. Was there any reference to a real-life person in that picture that he drew of the individual who
engaged in all the research on survival?
Right.
Yeah. I wondered that, and I've traced it, and I've not been able to find it. It could well have been. It sounds, and he makes such an appropriate comment. The person mixes up the means and the ends. It wasn't that what the person was doing was wrong. Forgot the whole point of what the person was doing, which is then why it traces those who try and prove God then end up not able to love the God they prove. Same kind of point. So I don't know the answer to the question. I haven't been able to find whether. Some of his stuff does refer to actual people. I don't know in that particular situation. Any other immediate questions? Otherwise, we'll go on and pick up several points that, from my perspective, need to go back, that we need to go back and look at. For those of you that have books, let's look at page 67, right after the dialogue really gets rolling. He asked the key question that I think in reality troubles us more than we might often think about. That is there really a way out of hell into heaven? And his answer here is, I don't know how you view it, but I think is a piece of marvelous theology that's not heard often enough. Let me just read the key points there that Bob read earlier. He says it depends on how you're using the words. If they leave the gray town behind, it will not have been hell. To any that leave it, it is purgatory. Now, whether you like the doctrine of purgatory or not is, in my opinion, beside the point at the moment, because this is a fantasy story to help us to try and get a hold of something. And perhaps you had better not call this country heaven, he says. Not deep heaven, you understand. You can call it the valley of the shadow of life. A beautiful turn on the phrase, which of course is out of the 23rd Psalm, the valley of the shadow of death. So he makes of the entryway into heaven the valley of the shadow of life. To those who stay here, that is, who take the bus trip and stay, then it's been heaven all along. I think what he's trying to say is in our hands, and it's a daily, momentary choice we're making. And if you want to hang on to hell, you're probably going to have it. And you, for none of us, is hell precisely the same thing. It's the hell that you choose in those moments in your own life before God that you hold off God from you. And you hold off God long enough, and God, that in the beautiful phrase toward the end that Chuck was referring to yesterday, we talked to, we'll come back to again, when God says back to us, okay, thy will be done. Come back to that later. I think that's what we're saying here. And I don't know how you perceive it, but for me, this is a very liberating view of a way to get hold of heaven and hell, so that when you engage in the earthly activities, peace and justice in Central America, ecology, how to get a new church going, any of the daily institutional life activities, you see it as a reflection that the mercy is upon you. And if you will have, as he said in another place, if you will but have God's joy, it's yours. Now if you want to resist it, okay, that's yours too. It's so simple, it kind of just takes us and stops us in our tracks. We could laugh at a number of the things that are in here.
Is that what Christ meant when he said there's no way to the Father but through me?
Okay, good. Let's take that. Take that phrase and interpret that phrase in light of what C.S. Lewis is saying. Good point. Try and interpret.
Accepting Christ makes God a reality.
Okay, what is there in C.S. Lewis that would help us to define what, to use the phrase, accepting Christ means?
It's a choice.
Choice? Clearly a choice.
Doing his will. Yeah. Doing his will.
What's the beginning, as we emphasized yesterday, in the prayer that we're taught? What's the phrase that comes right before?
Thy will be done.
Thy will be done. Thy will be done. Now, Christ becomes for us the absolutely irreplaceable central means of that joy. Why? Because it's the means God offers us for forgiveness, which is our means of joy. There is no joy. There is no heaven without repentance. And that's not a one-time thing. It's a daily, everyday act. It's a choice again to accept joy. And if you're going to accept joy, God's joy, you're going to accept it on God's terms, which means you're going to reject everything that would keep you back from your journey. Including, and this is what we, as those of us who've been a part of the journey for some time, have to remind ourselves, including judgment of others. Standing in judgment on that other person's journey. Including thinking that my way of accepting it has got to be somebody else's way of doing so. A letting go of all that kind of false preoccupation. Your journey is what God calls you to. I would say the reason that what was just emphasized here, that the only way to the Father is through Christ, is that Christ shows us time and again that the way to joy, is through giving up of self. We've known that all along. Greater love has no person than what? Yes, precisely the same point. Did you hear what I just said?
No.
Then that you lay down your life for another. In other words, you come to God through accepting this new life. You lay down your life for another. Your journey to heaven is in accepting the joy for you, which is in renouncing the self that would keep you from heaven and accepting the self that God gives you back.
And in yesterday's story, the chapter 4, it's the way of grace or mercy rather than getting what I deserve.
Yes.
And the guy couldn't accept heaven in yesterday's story because he had to accept grace and he didn't want to. He wanted justice.
Yeah, and that's another reason why this point is so important. If you want justice, if you want your rights,
you've chosen hell.
You've chosen hell. Uh-huh.
So the way to the Father through Christ is the way of grace, way of mercy, rather than the way of getting what I deserve.
Yeah.
Or what I've earned.
Yeah.
I wonder if other people have had the misconception. A light just dawned on me now that quotation about lay down your life for another life.
Yeah.
Not for another person's life, but that for another life for you.
Well, that's in the
you got it.
Image about
you got it.
Dying in order to find life, isn't it?
You got it. You got
dying
it.
Dying to self in order to find life.
Yeah. She said it. There it is. You want your life? You want joy? Yeah. What do? We go about claiming it in the crummiest, silliest, most stupid ways of hanging on to the most incredible things and lies. Whether it's intellectualism or cynicism or shame or whatever it is that we hang on to because we don't trust God enough that He will give us the joy He's promised us. We want it on our own terms. And so is we've continually heard, when we pray, "Thy will be done," we're really saying, "No, I want my will be done."
Where is the balance, though, when Paul says, "I do the very thing I don't want to do"?
Right. Several things I could say. Anybody want to pick up on that?
That's why it's a continuing thing, because we continue to do that.
That's part of it. Anybody else want to pick up on that? Good comment.
I think it was in here, in this chapter, he describes addiction of someone with an itch or a little pleasure, and it's not very big, but he wants to have this pleasure, and even after the pleasure is gone, he still wants it, and won't give it up. And, you know, maybe that's what.
But there are people, for reasons maybe out of their control, that have not had bonding when they're children, and as adults have become psychopaths that really don't have a choice.
I don't know how many of you went on the nature walk, I guess you call it, this afternoon with Joe Gordon. If you have any chance to get in any of these sessions, I urge you to do so. It's good stuff. What it reminded me of again, and this is only a short detour back to your question, because it directly related. He showed us time and time again in that nature walk that things are usually not what they seem. Any of the rest of you with us in that walk? Isn't that kind of one way to summarize one of the things he was saying? You think you see something in reality, and often you're misperceiving it. He showed us how when you can show sunlight through something, and you can look at it from one perspective, and it reflects as a square, and you pull back off again, and it's a circle. Now, why am I saying all that? If that's true in nature, how much more true it is of the spiritual life. I get more and more convinced that God's mercy is so far greater than we're able to conceive and that our minds are capable of taking hold of. If God in Christ is truly God, then the people that we're describing are surely encompassed by God's mercy as much as you and I. Maybe more so. Maybe more so. We have a choice. I don't know how God sees that. And I don't know how God sees you. I know I'm beginning to get some inklings of how God sees me. Namely, He wills joy for me. And I'm convinced that God wills joy for those people as well. And whatever is going on in their hearts, whatever is going on in their minds as they make their choices, I'm sure that if they will have it, if they will have it, God's mercy covers them. Now our task, I'm absolutely convinced, our task, once we've experienced this kind of heaven, is to reach out on earth in ministry. Whether it's social justice is your calling, or evangelism is your calling, or whatever is your calling, you go do it. Now, I don't know if that gets at part of your question. I want to take that and pick up on the other thing you said. What about the balance of when we continue to be hassled by various things? My experience, and C.S. Lewis points this out, my experience is, and this is a difficult saying, but hear it through and then raise questions if you want. From my own life, let me speak for myself and a few other people I've known well in close encounter in Bible study or in spiritual discussion groups or in counseling opportunities, we continue to be preoccupied with ourselves. And it's almost like it's magic. The moment you stop being preoccupied with yourself, some of those little petty things start to fade away. And the more you try and concentrate on dealing with them, the bigger and bigger issues they get. And the moment you can get outside of yourself, which is one of the points he constantly makes, get outside of yourself, give up your life, quit worrying about all those little things. He even says, did you catch that point on sensuality? It's a lesser sin. Did you catch that? I think that's terribly important to recognize. Sensuality in itself is not wrong. It's what we do with it that makes the problem. I think that's some of what he's trying to get at here. Good questions. I want to make sure we go on and pick up on some of the other themes that are here, unless there's anything else immediately on this. Okay, take page 69. Bottom. Milton was right.
The choice of every lost soul can be expressed in the words, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
Hold on. Tell me some of what you hear, what you think about when you hear that. Better to reign in hell then serve in heaven.
Well, what do you hear in that?
Power.
Power.
Control.
Control.
Ego.
Ego.
Being on top.
Being on top.
My way or else.
My way or else. And some of the more subtle ways that occurs. It isn't only those, like some people like myself, who get some of our enjoyment out of teaching, and that can be fun and can also be an incitement to pride. Any of the other ways, the constant interplay between husband and wife for control and power. And usually the one who supposedly has the power is usually the one who doesn't. And how we subtly seek to go after it. Or the marvelous example of the child. Remember, he used the child who would rather skip dinner and sulk than to say that it was wrong. Now, isn't that also an example? Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. I'm going to insist that I don't have to apologize to my brother. Parents, I'm not going to listen to him. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
That sounds like that phrase, would you rather be right or happy?
Say a little more.
Would you rather be right or happy? It's like you can't have both. Sometimes. Okay,
now I'm picking up right in quotes there. Yeah, that. Yeah, no. Okay, right, then I'm with you. It took me a moment, but I caught up.
Is that from Pilgrim's Progress, the quotation from Milton? Do you know?
No. I have tried to find where it's from, and I have not. He uses Milton several places, and it's probably either Paradise Lost or his poem Comus. But John Bunyan in Pilgrim's Progress used much of that same kind of concept. But turn it around and not just see it in somebody else. See it in yourself. The desire to be right. There, that's picking up your phrase. The desire to be right rather than acknowledge to somebody near and dear to you that you were wrong. Oh, it's so hard. So hard. Some people can't deal with shame. So they'd rather hide their shame than dealing with the problem it created in the first place. And how often haven't we had the experience that once you deal with it, it amounted to precisely nothing? Better to reign now. If you insist, C.S. Lewis's point is, if you insist on hanging on to that desire to reign, better to reign now. You are already participating in your own private hell. And if you keep it up long enough, you'll have what you wish. You'll have your own private hell. And if you let go of it, you're already participating in heaven. You're already sharing some of the Christ light because you've been willing to let that part of you go. Okay, let's go to that absolutely marvelous phrase. Page 72 that Chuck picked up on yesterday, because that's much of what we've been saying all along. Bottom page 72. C.S. Lewis asks George MacDonald, but what of the poor ghosts who never get into the omnibus at all? You hear your question there? What of the poor folks who never get into the omnibus at all?
Everyone who wishes it does. Never feel.
Okay, I want to come back to that. C.S. Lewis's point is that God's mercy is so great that if we wish it, he will find a way, he or she will find a way for it to be the case. Because God's the kind of God God is in Christ. Just as Bob just read, everyone who wishes it does. Everyone who wishes it has an opportunity. Even in our most desperate moments, if there's a wish for God's mercy, that's the entry, little shiny trail of light coming into you for God's mercy. And then these marvelous phrases pick up the rest of the sentence. Apparently.
Everyone who wishes it does. Never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says in the end, thy will be done. All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. To those who knock, it is opened.
What do you think about his C.S. Lewis' marvelous turning of the phrase, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," as if God's saying back to us in the end, okay, your will be done. And if your prayer has been, in any way, shape, or form, maybe it isn't the classic Christian language, "Thy will be done on earth as in heaven," but if in any way your prayer has been, what's another great phrase in the New Testament? "God be merciful to me, a sinner." Not the same thing, isn't it? Isn't the prayer, "God be merciful to me, a sinner," very much the same as "Thy will be done on earth as in heaven"? If that's your prayer at all, God will have you. And if you refuse, "Thy will be done," and say, "My will be done," God says to you in the end, okay, your will be done. That's what you wanted. It's another way of saying that the greatest gift God gives us is freedom. It's a frightening gift. It's a scary gift. Those who were here yesterday know that one of the things C.S. Lewis said, he tried to emphasize the ominous sense that was about this whole entry once you got off the bus. And it was only as you went further along into this great new country that you began to sense again the joy that's possible when you give up claims to yourself. We have just a few more minutes. We can catch one other quick section and take advantage of Bob's being here, unless any of you have any immediate questions about any of this part so far. No immediate questions. Let's take one more section then, because it's good. Would somebody like to read? There's about a paragraph that takes. It's a woman who's frightened for herself. I don't think it makes much difference whether it's a man or woman reading it. But if somebody just likes to read again and you enjoy it and have a book in front of you, would you like to take that portion and get to us? One paragraph. Anybody like to do it?
Where?
It'll be on page 73. I'll lead into it. Be on page 73. Would anyone like to do it? Okay, got somebody back here. I'll lead into it. This is right after this section we've just been looking at. At this moment, we were suddenly interrupted by the thin voice of a ghost talking at enormous speed. So if you can read it quickly. Looking behind us, we saw the creature. It was addressing one of the solid or bright people and was doing so too busily to notice us. Every now and then the solid spirit tried to get in word without success. The ghost's talk was like this.
"Oh, my dear, I've had such a dreadful time. I don't know how I ever got here at all. I was coming with Eleanor Stone, and we'd arranged the whole thing, and we were to meet at the corner of Sing Street. I made it perfectly plain because I knew what she was like, and if I told her once, I told her 100 times I would not meet her outside that dreadful Marjorie Banks woman's house, not after the way she treated me. That was one of the most dreadful things that happened to me. I've been dying to tell you because I felt sure you'd tell me I acted rightly. No, wait a minute, dear, till I told you. I tried living with her when I first came and it was all fixed up. She was to do the cooking and I was to look after the house. And I did think I was going to be comfortable after all I'd been through, but she turned out to be so changed, absolutely selfish, and not a particle of sympathy for anyone but herself. And as I once said to her, I do think I'm entitled to a little consideration because you at least lived out your time, but I oughtn't to have been here for years and years yet. But of course, I'm forgetting you don't know I was murdered, simply murdered, dear. That man should never have operated. I ought to be alive today, and they simply starved me in that dreadful nursing home, and no one ever came near me." And
the shrill, monotonous whine died away. Didn't that strike home, though? So what she's saying? The shrill, monotonous whine dined away as the speaker, still accompanied by the bright patients at her side, one of the bright people, moved out of hearing.
"What troubles you, son?"
Who wants to read C.S. Lewis? You want to do it again? You're reading it for.
"What troubles you, son?"
"I am troubled, sir, because that unhappy creature doesn't seem to me to be the sort of soul that ought to be in even in danger of damnation. She isn't wicked. She's only a silly,
garrulous.
Thanks. Garrulous old woman who has got into a habit of grumbling, and one feels that a little kindness and rest and change would put her all right.
Yeah, that's what she once was. That's maybe what she still is. If so, she certainly will be cured. But the whole question is whether she is now a grumbler.
I should have thought there was no doubt about that.
Ah, but you misunderstand me. The question is whether she's a grumbler or only a grumble. If there is a real woman, even the least trace of one, still there inside the grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under all those ashes, we'll blow it till the whole pile is red and clear. But if there's nothing but ashes, we'll not go on blowing them in our eyes forever. They must be swept up.
What an image.
Yeah. Go on.
But how can there be a grumble without a grumbler?
The whole difficulty of understanding hell is that the thing to be understood is so nearly nothing. But you'll have had experiences. It begins with a grumbling mood, and yourself still distinct from it, perhaps criticizing it. And yourself in a dark hour may will that mood, embrace it. You can repent and come out of it again. But there may come a day when you can do that no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood, nor even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. But come, you're here to watch and listen. Lean on my arm and we'll go for a little walk.
Now, if that paragraph doesn't describe daily life for all of us at one time or another in our life, I don't know what describes human life. And C.S. Lewis moves quickly on when he says, but come, let's go on, because there's going to be other experiences. But who has not grumbled? And who has not known what it's like at times to wish to return to that grumbling because of injured pride? Hurts. So I would like to grumble. After all the things my wife has done to me, I have a right to grumble. Or all the things my children have said, I have a right to grumble. Or all the things that pastor has done, I have a right to grumble. Or all the way those people are acting today, I have a right to grumble. And oh Lord, you know my troubles, and I'm such a great grumbler.
I like it where he says, and you can repent and come out of it again.
Yeah, yeah. And his point is, but the longer you hold on to the grumble, the more you are going to be only a grumble and no longer the grumbler who has a chance to exercise control of it. And sadly enough, maybe some of you in your own lives and around you, you've known people who get reduced almost to that. And that's a tragedy. And that's where the practice of patience on earth and long-suffering love becomes terribly important, without you becoming the martyr in the process. That's another form of putting yourself down. Yeah. Well, our time is just about up. We're going to, on Thursday afternoon at 4, when we pick up again, go on to even more graphic imagery of what this journey is all about. And I hope you've begun to sense that in imagery language, keep in mind this is imagery language, C.S. Lewis is trying to help us live now and not get worried about heaven or hell, but live now. To realize now, this evening, tomorrow morning, back down off the mountain, accept joy, accept the mercies that are there. And begin the process of sharing that without being concerned about yourself. Yourself, you already have the joy. So you don't need to be preoccupied with this other stuff. I think that's his message. Any other final questions before we need to stop in a couple minutes? Or observations or anything like your marvelous insight that you're really accepting your own life?
Picking up a new life.
Yeah. Yes, picking up a new life.
I was thinking about the concept of the grumbling transfers to me to be resentment,
yes,
which is the fuel for addiction, which is the machinery for shame and this vicious circle that mm-hmm. that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah. And pretty soon, like this old woman, she gets totally caught up in it without an ember left.
And boy, I got to tell you, one of the greatest callings today, it seems to me, is that people have the patience to work in senior nursing homes.
Okay. Well, we'll pick up Thursday afternoon. We'll have more of the text in front of us then. Bob, thanks. You were the ideal Georgian.